Welcome to another exciting interview here at Kung Fu Conversations. I'm a little giddy about this one because I actually got to talk to this gentleman over COVID a few times in my bus, and he was kind to share some information, kind to just give me some ideas and pointers on everything. He probably started maybe the Kung Fu podcasting. If he didn't start it, he was one of the first and maybe the best out there. That is the talented Ken Gullett from the Internal Fighting Arts Podcast, which is our guest today. Ken, thank you for being on Kung Fu Conversations. We're thrilled to have you.
It's great to talk with you both.
Owen, do you want to start us off?
You go for it, man.
Okay. So, Ken, we've heard your background on multiple podcasts. you started in Shaolin-Do.
Yeah.
Back in, did you say 1973, my friend?
50 years ago this September.
That's amazing. And then you moved on from there. In your training, let's see, you also did another lineage of Bagua and Xingyi. You've done some Tai Chi. If I remember right, was there ever a stint in there where you had done some of the Yi Li Chuan? I can't remember.
Yes, Yi Li Chuan was my first experience in the internal arts.
Okay.
Allegedly.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then from there, you've moved on. You're have an amazing teaching platform. You teach Xingyi, Bagua, and Tai Chi. You've been a practitioner of the Chen Village Method for how many years, sir?
25 years.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And then
and you a have decade before that, I was doing Yang style in the Yi Li Chen system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, okay. And then recently, in the last 3 years, you've been moving into the Beijing method with Nabil.
Yeah, the Chen Yu, Xiao Kui, Chen Yu, Nabil Rene lineage. Yeah.
Fantastic. So I have an odd question for you, and I'm not going to sweep you off your feet because well, I know you've got good balance.
I have an odd answer.
You started in Shaolin-Do, which wasn't, as you learned, and you share in some other podcast, might not have been one, the most authentic, or two, the most genuine experience. As a teacher for all these years, is there something that you've taken away from that bad experience that you have learned from as a teacher now that you, one, try not to do, or two, you know, try not to impose on your students? What are some of the things that, even though that might not have been a great place to start, what are some of the lessons that you still carry on and your own practice and your own teaching today, Ken?
Well, one of the best things I learned there was sparring and some of the tactics and techniques. For example, some of these techniques won me tournaments even in my 50s. Especially, you know, you come in on a guy and you grab that lead arm and you sweep his foot and hit him on his way when he's off balance. So there are always good things, even in bad systems, that you can learn from. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things. I just, as I got older and started teaching, I thought, you know, just be honest. So many people invent backgrounds. I mean, one of my teachers said that he spoke to a voice in a room for 3 days, a disembodied voice, and came up with his system. And I'd spent a lot of time and money and effort in that system and couldn't believe what I was hearing. And that was the start of my departure. It's just, you know, just have some integrity.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the things I didn't realize when I was in Shaolin-Do that it was not what it was billed to be until I went to that tournament in Columbus, Ohio in 76 and saw a kung fu that blew me away. And at that point, I started looking for other things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important for a lot of people who are in the martial arts, even now. Sorry about the dog. Even now, I meet people and I've got some new information that has changed me a little bit. And I'll show it to someone and they'll react with, well, that's not the way we do it. And I think You know, you've just got to be open to information that improves your art, no matter where, what teacher or what lineage it comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great answer, Ken. And, you know, I also am a Shaolin Do veteran from,
yes.
Yeah, I was there for a couple of years, up here in Boulder. So, and you know, my experience is very much like yours. I think I really appreciated your thoughtfulness and the way that you were able to explain your takeaways and the things that really the value that really helped you. And I look back on my experience there with very much the same. I got very much the same things out of it. So it's good to hear somebody else from a different generation in that same organization who came away with some of that same stuff.
It's interesting that when I was starting, you know, the first several years I was in martial arts, I didn't care anything about forms. And I don't remember one form I learned, but, you know, I think the first one I learned was a bastardization of a basic karate form. Mm-hmm. Low block, step, punch, turn, low block, step, punch, key up at the end. So, mm-hmm. And that's a nice little form for what it is. But I learned no body mechanics. I learned nothing about anything sophisticated. And mm-hmm. so that's what changed over time. And it wasn't until I started in Shin style before I learned anything that gave depth to the internal aspect of the art.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started infusing my other art with those mechanics.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any exposure? I know, you know, during my time there, they were teaching, you know, Tai Chi and Bagua and Xing Yi. And did you have any exposure to any of, were they doing any of that?
Oh, no, never heard those words.
Okay.
And I was there for 3 years, got a third degree brown belt and was in college at the time. But yeah, I never heard Xing Yi, Tai Chi, Bagua. That is something they obviously added on as the years passed.
Sure. Yeah.
It's called the Shaolin Do Karate,
mm-hmm.
and, which is really bizarre when you think about it. But that was before the internet, before we had much information at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It was very, it was very difficult. Even when I started, there was hardly any information out there. It was very difficult to come across information and be able to discern. Oh, well, there are, like you said, you went to that tournament and all of a sudden it was like, oh, wait, there are other things out here and good things.
Yeah.
Things that you were interested in.
Lexington, Kentucky, he was the star.
Sure.
Yep.
That's when people were saying, you know, he can slice his arm with a knife and it won't bleed. He's got that much control over his body. That legend was going out there because of things like the Kung Fu TV show and,
right. You
know, and things where sometimes it was a bit mystical, but it's all right. It leads to better things. You know, even being exposed to a teacher who isn't very good or what he advertises can sometimes point you in a direction that you can continue on and learn better things from better teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I always like to think that it helps me sort of discern, what I don't like and what I didn't want and the things that didn't, you know, that sort of the lack of depth over time. I was like, oh yeah, I'm not getting a lot of what I would expect, like you were saying, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah. And where did you go from there?
Well, I started into Taekwondo. I found a teacher who taught privately. His name was Roy Crawford. I think he still has a school in Lexington. We're both in our 20s. He may have been a year or two younger than I was. But he had been successful in tournaments. And so I started studying with him. And there was a teacher named Randy Chandless who started a school. He went on to California later. And I studied Taekwondo for a while, learned some great kicks.
Mm-hmm.
About that time, I saw Bill Wallace knock out a guy with a hook kick.
Yeah, he did that. He's got a lot of that in his belt.
I added that to my arsenal, and that was winning me tournaments. Just before I lost the line, I think, won a tournament with a hook kick. And, you know, you fake them with a side kick, they're thinking down, and boom. And as you get into your 50s, no one expects you to kick them in the head to begin with.
Right.
So the deception is a really interesting part of fighting. You make them think you're going somewhere and you go somewhere else. It was one of the keys to my sparring strategy over the years. And even in the full contact match I had, I was faking the guy and going high, or faking high going low. It works against all kinds of people.
How about next, Ken? Where did you find your way outside of Taekwondo? When did you first start doing something that you felt had a Chinese quality to it, but not maybe the full in depth that you have now with the Chinese methodologies that you study?
Well, I was in the news business, and I got a job. I was kind of without a teacher, but still practicing. I had friends, and we would meet and spar. That's what we would do. And I moved to Cincinnati, and after I had a young family, you know, two young girls, and working in news. So you know how it is. Sometimes you just have to take time off.
Yeah.
But I found Karen Vaughn, who taught Tian Shan Pai Kung Fu.
Yep, I'm familiar with it.
And back in 1981, 82, 80, she was in all the karate magazines listed as one of the top Midwest competitors. And so I studied with her, but for a brief time, but that was my first introduction to Chinese arts, actually, unless you count Shaolin Do, but I don't really.
Do you remember the small, real quick question? Do you remember the small time training with her? Because I'm familiar with people that practice that art. Did you guys do quite a bit of joint locks at all in your training? Anything like the Na?
Yeah, I was fairly new to it. And so I was learning their basic techniques and sparring. I don't remember a whole lot of Chin Na, but I think she had a couple of pretty experienced people. And she was a great martial artist, probably still is. You know, the thing is, Tian Shan Pai was another one of those systems that was invented by a guy and claimed a different lineage. And I really feel like she was misled and yet was a good enough martial artist that she was good. And that was the first time I won a first place trophy at a tournament, was wearing we wore the wushu outfits, a yellow track suit kind of thing. And so I went to a tournament, and the first time I won a first place. So I was pretty excited, but I competed in forms, I think, but didn't do well. I still wasn't into forms until I started into the internal arts. And from there, I moved to Omaha. I lost the job in Cincinnati. News is a horrible business, and had a new guy come in, and he wanted to make changes. So I ended up moving to Omaha, and that's where I found the Yilichuan system and started studying Yang Tai Chi, Xing Yi Bagua, Qigong, and acupuncture, that sort of thing.
Was it Sam Chen that was actually teaching the Yilichuan
system? No, it was Philip Starr, Pete Starr.
Okay.
He's written several books on the market.
Yep.
Familiar.
That was, you know, we were good martial artists. We kicked butt in regional tournaments. I felt it was really good. But there were some mystical aspects to it. I didn't really, you know, I decided I would give it a shot. I opened my mind. I studied acupuncture for 2 years. I had all the equipment. I could do it. I can't now. I've forgotten it, but you know, there came there. when you say you can look at me and you can see my aura and you can tell maybe illnesses or weaknesses, I tried it. We worked on it. And at some point you have to call bullshit.
Yes. And, yes, sir. Yes, sir. But
I'm needed back on planet Earth now, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of thing. And that's where, you know, there was the drill where the teacher said, if you run at me, I'm going to drop and draw a circle in the air as I drop. Mm. Weed your chi over me. You're going to fall instead of. And of course, we all did because that's what we were told to do.
Right.
And that's that and the story about the disembodied voice made me think, okay.
Time to go.
Time to go.
Was there any, when you were working with him, was there any connection between the forms and maybe drill sets? Or was it you were doing like a Shingi or Bagua form, but you were back to maybe point sparring or things like, or karate sparring, if you will?
Yeah, there was that. There wasn't, there was some application work, but not very
detailed.
It was a harder form. You know, I've got video of me doing the forms, the Shingi forms and the tournaments, and man, I'm just blasting through it without much relaxation and, you know, the yin yang. And mm-hmm. even later on, I was in tournaments and told the story about the judge kept scoring me low. And I finally said, what am I doing wrong? And she said, you blow through your forms like a house on fire. You have to have some pacing in there.
Yeah.
And I walked away thinking, well, what does she know? She's karate. And then I thought, oh, I looked at the video and thought, she's absolutely right. I mean, there's got to mm-hmm. be some hard and soft, some yin and yang. And so that it's good sometimes to ask people, even outsiders, their opinions. Kind of a sobering moment. Yeah, there were a lot of things that were good about the art. It was not internal. It was not compared with what I learned later.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It was basically karate tension a lot of times, except when you did Tai Chi, when you were emptying your mind, which is not what you want to do to begin with, but just real soft. And that's not what I see as Tai Chi, but it was at that time. After 10 years, I thought, well, I really know Tai Chi. And then I met Jim Krishamania in Chin Style. And in 1 hour, I said, everything's crap. I've got to start over.
Yeah.
So.
And there you went. There you went. That's something special too, Ken. I got to give you props for that, because a lot of people, after studying at that point, it sounds like a couple decades, are not willing to let go of everything that they've previously learned.
Well, I had won a gold medal doing the Yang 24 at a national tournament, the AAU Kung Fu Nationals. Mm. So I thought, I know Tai Chi. And then met with Jim, and he was explaining to me, showing me the ground path and showing me the teacher test where you knock a student away without changing your stance. Mm-hmm. And it just was the difference in quality and strength and the mechanics. I just, you know, you just have to go with, man, I don't know. You see it everywhere these days. Mm-hmm. You see it all throughout life, through in religion and politics. Once you're invested in something, it doesn't matter what information comes your way. You say, no, I'm sticking with my guy. Or my beliefs.
Yep.
I've never mm-hmm. been that way. Never been that way. I guess for a while I was as a kid, but then I just changed religion, changed political philosophy, changed martial arts, open to information. Mm-hmm.
That's adult kung fu. That's adult right? kung fu.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, you have to adapt. You know, that's part of our philosophy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so.
You change and you get better every day. And that should be everyone's goal. I'm getting better every day. I want to be a better person every day.
Yeah. So
what do I have to do? How can I connect with people and use the philosophy of the Kung Fu TV show and the Taoism and Zen Buddhism? How do I become a better person and connect? You know, being connected is so important in sparring and so important in life and centering. When I sparred people, I got to the point in tournaments where I was relaxed and I was enjoying myself. And they would get a shot in and I'd say, oh, man, that was great. And the judges were just amazed. And my competitors got into it and enjoyed it, most of them. But you just have fun and enjoy people and try to get better yourself. Learn from what you do and the mistakes you make.
Mm-hmm. That's real life Kung Fu right there.
Yeah, you try. And you know, I've been through a lot of downs and a lot of ups, but I lost the daughter, I lost jobs, lost marriages, but you persist because it is yin yang. Now, there are going to be bad times, there are going to be bad teachers, going to be bad experiences, but if you persist and work toward what you want in your life, everything becomes positive. You know, the wheel turns.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good lesson.
Very good.
Owen?
Nope.
Ken,
go ahead.
Do you still practice? And would you tell us a little bit about guided chaos? Do you still use some of that? The as for push hands?
No, I never was really a guided chaos student. My friend Evan Yang is.
Okay.
And he's studied with me some. And so we could exchange information.
Sure.
I have been to two or three of the guided chaos workshops. And, you know, the best thing I picked up from them is, the contact flow, they call it. Mm-hmm. And you can adapt that to Tai Chi, Xing Yi, Bagua. We even do it with Bagua. You know, you touch an opponent and then you, as they attack, you're looking for the ways to wind around it and uproot, control the center. And in push hands, I think it just immediately was a connection. So the way it works, if people are listening to this, you touch hands with a partner, even both hands, and you're both trying in slow motion, I mean really slow, and that's the hard part, to attack your partner and defend. And at the same time, they're trying to defend and attack. And you really learn, but your partner has to really be slow with you at your pace. Once they speed up, that's not what it's about. Mm-hmm. But when a punch is coming at you, and okay, how do I deal with that right now? And how do I defend? How am I attacking? It really teaches you a lot about yourself. And then you gradually speed up.
Right. But
you have to go slow for a while. It's when I experienced that with Evan, I thought, this is what push hands should help teach you. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you get locked into patterns and you go to a push hands class. Half the class has never done it. So you're stuck on this or the double hand, mm-hmm. learning the pattern. And you never get beyond that point to where you apply it for application. But push hands is for fighting. It's for sparring. It's to bridge from form to fighting. And you can see a lot of the weaknesses in your form in how you do push hands. Mm-hmm. And there are people who tell me, well, once you start trying to lock someone or sweep them, then it becomes all competitive and that's not push hands. But my God, Tai Chi is a martial art.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Everything is martial in Tai Chi. And if you don't have that part of it, you're not studying the complete art.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, sometimes people are, they mistake softness with what Tai Chi should be. But no, you know, if I'm working on it, I'm flowing like water, like Bruce Lee said. You flow like water, you find your way in, and you deflect. And, you know, your Wing Chun background, it is a perfect complement to the idea of flowing like water. Punches coming in, I deflect, and I come around and just flow fine through my way through your defense.
There's when I teach my students, I try to really point something out for the Wing Chun. Is a lot of I like food, as you can tell, and I always use the term al dente. Wing Chun should be al dente, right? If you overcook it, it's limp. It falls apart and it has no structure. And I think too many people, whether it be the internal arts or even something like Wing Chun, when they hear the word relax or soft, instantly in their mind, they go to limp.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that noodle's going to dissolve. You put some sauce on it, it's not going to be there. Or if it's not cooked, which is too hard, it's going to be brittle and it's going to snap. So you're looking to find, where is your al dente? And you want it to be off of structure, not off of muscles. So I always start with the skeletal load and how gravity on those postures and stances that we use in Wing Chun. How does the skeleton and how does your posture hold force? Not only of your own body, but that of the partner. And then from there, you can start to over time as you continue to gradually do these drills over and over and over and over again. Later on down the road, when you're really good at those drills and you have balance, you have stance, you have structure, which, you know, posture to structure, then you can start to ramp it up.
Yeah.
But if you start 100% with nothing or 100% too stiff, it's you're not going to get good work out of it. And I think that's got to be something that we do better in the Chinese arts.
I think of, playing a piano. Okay, you put your hands down on the piano and you can't play it if they're stiff.
No.
You can't play it if they're too limp. There's a relaxed state of readiness that you're in. And that's the key in the internal arts, finding that relaxed state of readiness where you've got the structure but can flow around that structure. You know, one of my favorite things in Tai Chi is push. Sometimes guys will come in and I'll say, okay, take me down, especially other martial arts. Say, okay, grab me, take me down. And then I use Tai Chi to try to take them down without using a lot of muscular power.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can even empty. They grab you, they're pushing here, give it to them. And now I've still got the mechanics and the structure here.
That's right.
To take advantage. And that to me is one of the reasons I'm so fascinated with Tai Chi, using those mechanics without a lot of muscular tension to, you know, the Peng Lu Jian, pluck all those energies empty. It's a shame people misunderstand empty force like they do.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's shooting energy out of your palm or something. And all it is empty. Now, how do you flow around?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I had a student recently who was had been doing a different system of Tai Chi, and that system really focused on song. Right. This idea of relaxation, but they had a very, it was more like of Randall's analogy of sort of the overcooked noodle and, it was really interesting because, you know, just a few minutes we talked about it. I just pushed on him a little bit and I let him push on me. And we sort of talked about structure. We talked about force in the body and we talked about, and then I started to think about it and I was like, well, song is a really important principle, and it's only one skill among many skills that you need to do the art well, whether it's, you know, Tai Chi or Xing Yi or Bagua. It's just, it's one skill, and their system sort of took it to an extreme.
Yeah.
It's where it sort of divorced itself from all of the other skills that were needed. So, you know, I like this. I like the idea of sort of, you know, building a better race car, so to speak, with a lot of different skills as opposed to just focus on a single skill.
Yeah. You know, when I started teaching, I started teaching Chin style. I wanted to organize it and explain it in ways that were clear. Mm-hmm. It would make sense to me. How would I want to learn?
Yeah.
So I broke up some body mechanics. And the first thing when people come to me, I teach them is the ground path. Mm-hmm. And no matter what their martial art background is, when I ask them, do you know what the ground path is? They go, no. And so we start with that and Peng Jin. Mm-hmm. The ground and Peng are in every move.
Yeah.
You have to have them.
Yep.
From there, opening, closing the quad and rotating the dantian and whole body movement, silk reeling. Those are the six. But you need a lot more than those six, but those are six that I like to teach in the beginning as we go.
But what I like about that, Ken, is you've talked about a teaching methodology. Yes. So you're not just out there winging it. It's like, okay, do the form. Okay, now we're going to do push hands. Okay, now we're going to do applications. Okay, now go home. Well, how does the form relate to push hands? How does the form relate to applications?
Right.
How does the form relate to silk reeling? And then, or you take the other one, how does silk reeling relate to all those other things? And then how does the principles also inject? Because it's not like, you were saying, it's not just one thing. It's got to be many things, but you also have to find a way to teach. And I think Nabil was talking about it, coming up with good vocabulary.
Yeah.
Good vocabulary to explain what you're asking your student to do. Because I think sometimes as teachers that have done the teaching methodology for a long time, we just assume everyone walks in and we forget what it's like to be a white belt. Where do you start from? Start from the ground.
Yeah.
And then working your way up from there. So I think that's great. So you've worked on your teaching methodology and your terminology. Speaking of, I loved listening to Nabil talk about that. It's like sometimes I think we really have to work on what our terms are and what we're using to explain things to our students.
Yeah.
Working with Nabil now, what are some of the terms and wording that you use a little bit differently than when you were just doing the Chen Village style?
I think more about body method. It's you know, that's not a term that was really that familiar with me until I started reading some of the things that, you know, Nabil and Marin Spivak is also a Chen Yu disciple. And, you know, they were a little critical of the Chen Village way, which I love the Chen Village Tai Chi. Mm-hmm. I also love Nabil's Chen Yu's version. But yeah, the methodology, you know, opening, closing the kwa, for example, I was doing that, but not quite the same way. Mm-hmm. There's a, you know, the dantian section between the crease of the legs, it moves differently and is more relaxed and moving, and the legs, you're feeling the spiraling going through the leg, through the toes. Mm-hmm. And I had never really experienced that because I wasn't necessarily taught that way. Mm-hmm. But immediately it made me feel more stable and stronger in my stance. You know, for example, if I'm shifting my weight to the left, I'm closing that leg, spiraling the thigh inward, spiraling the feet, big, a little toe to big toe, and I'm closed. It's really powerful. Then you shift and close the other leg, but a lot of differences. Little things. You know, you learn these same principles. It's just a different method of applying them. Mm-hmm. And I like it. I really like Nabil's way of teaching. And I've had some really good Chen style teachers. The Americans, Jim and Angie Krishmanya, Mark Wasson, they looked under the hood. They asked questions like Americans do. Mm-hmm. And they explained it in a pretty clear way. Nabil does the same thing. He's Siri's talking to me. So that's the main difference. Just little changes in the method. Mm-hmm.
So you've had a number of different Chen style teachers. Would you say that the commonality in the languaging that they were using, was there a commonality, or did you find that each teacher had to kind of develop their own vocabulary, so to speak, or ways to talk about and describe or organize the system?
Yeah,
it's kind of a broad question.
I made sense of it for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the early influences on me that made me seek out Chen style was Mike Sigmund. Mm-hmm. He was teaching in the 90s about ground path and Peng Jin and those concepts. And so I was buying his VHS tapes. Mm-hmm. And then in 97, he was on the listserv with a bunch of other Chen guys. And yep. That's how I said, hey, I need to study this. They sent me to Jim Krishmanya. So I think I forgot the question.
Well, really, I was interested in if the vocabulary that these different teachers had to develop around their methods.
So my vocabulary was heavily influenced by Mike Sigmund in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, Chen Xiao Wang, Chen Xiao Xing, they didn't really talk about these things in the same way. A lot of times it was, follow me through this Sukri Ling exercise, 1, 2, 3, 4. And they would come and correct your stance.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was fairly new to the art. They're not going to tell me a lot. I didn't know Mandarin. Sure. You know, Chen Xiaoxing showed me some very interesting things in push hands, but without explaining it, because he didn't speak English. I didn't right. speak his language, but he put me on the ground, and I learned after several times why.
Sure.
But, yeah, so I tried to make sense of it, and Jim and Angie helped a lot. Mark helped, and I would confirm things that I was thinking. Chen Wei Shen is a great teacher. She's in Kansas City.
You mention her a lot. I've looked her up. She's got some great stuff.
Well, she's a great human being and she's clarified things for me. And so, you know, it kind of confirmed, okay, I'm on the right path. I just need to get better at it. Mm-hmm. And Nabil teaches in even a little bit more direct, detailed, sophisticated way, and that appeals to me. I want the detail. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do? What am I doing? What am I trying to do? And how do I get to a better quality of movement? Mm-hmm. Allows me to have that relaxed power that I need. When someone tries to take me down, I take them down.
Sure. Sure.
The fighting aspect to me. You know, I'm 70, just turned 70.
But I congratulations.
Still, well, there's good and bad to that. But the good part is no one asks you, where do you see yourself in 10 years?
Right.
We might, Ken. We might.
But I still am fascinated with the movements and how they are applied in self-defense. Mm-hmm. I don't expect to ever be in a fight again, but after having been in a lot of fights growing up, I just love that aspect of it. And I think you need to understand that. And so with every movement I teach, it's the principle, it's the application. That's how that principle works. Mm. Just last night, I'm taking my guys through the Yilu form, and I'm using closing in the legs like Nabil is teaching. Mm-hmm. It's changing my Tai Chi. And so I was, you know, when you do a movement like Lazy About Tying the Coat, you're maybe not familiar, but say, part the wild horse's mane.
Sure.
Your hands moving out like you're knocking someone over your leg. Well, if your leg is moving to the left as your arm is moving, you're dissipating your energy. You're leaking energy. So you close that leg as that arm moves out, giving a more immovable object for the person to be knocked over. Mm-hmm. So those little things, we were going through that in our class last night. And then I was showing them, because I realized training with Nabil that my legs were moving outward when they actually should have been closing. So those are the kinds of things you can pick up from studying with other people that no one really explained to me before. And that I had great training, good teachers, but not, they were all on the same journey. And some of us are at a little different point in that journey. Mm-hmm. So they were teaching me as best they could at that time. And I'm doing the same and trying to get better.
You're talking about your attentions to detail and the things that Nabil has given to you, Ken. It's always fascinating because when I teach application with the Wing Chun, I'm like, well, you know, you should have this one shape of your hand and probably get 4 or 5 applications out of it. People are like, where are you coming up with this? I'm like, oh, it's right here in the form. It's over here in the wooden man. It's here in the knives. It's over here and things like that. How has working with Nabil, have you seen an older movement or maybe an older from the form and he uses an application and you're like, where did that come from? Has there been an application that Nabil's used on you that's just kind of surprised you? One, and two, given you an aha moment, maybe?
Well, we haven't, you know, most of my training with him has been online except for 2 workshops, one of them just last month in Philadelphia. So we haven't worked personally on a lot of applications, but if you watch his videos and Chen Yu's videos, I've had a lot of aha moments where, oh, okay, that's Chen Na. All right. I never really did it that way before. Some of the insight that you get. But see, sometimes their movements are a little different. You know, mm-hmm. Lazy About Tying the Coat Chin Village way, you start by doing circles with your arms, but they're doing all these different movements within that circle and circle and different hand movements that really lend themselves to Chin Na even more.
Very cool. Very cool.
Mm-hmm. It's good. It's all good. I still teach the Chin Village material. But as I learned with Nabil, it has had an influence on the way I do some of the movements within that form.
Sure.
This kind of reminds me of people that might do a Hebe method of Xingyi, and then they maybe do a seminar with somebody that does the Xia style or maybe the Song style or something like that. And even though you have your 5 elements, they're going to look different. You have your animals, they're going to look different. But it's maybe not so much in how you move, but the qualities of the movement. That you'll find that maybe softer quality in a Shaanxi style of Xingyi. Or maybe you might find a different way to look at the footwork in the Hebei method. And so you piecemeal out those, you write them down in your notes. And it's like, well, I've got the Hubei way to train it. I've got a Song way to train it, but I'm still training Xing Yi as a whole.
Yes.
And so maybe that's the way that you're looking at your own journey with Chen Tai Chi is I've got the Chen Village. I've got the Beijing style, but I'm still Ken Gullet doing Chen Tai Chi at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think everybody puts their own little flair on what they're learning, but try to recreate it as much as high quality as you can. But it's little things. I look for the things that excite me are, for example, I did a video this week on leaking energy.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. Go, Ken. So, this is great.
So I watch now every time I see someone on YouTube or whatever doing a Tai Chi form, they start with their feet together and they sink a little bit and they step their left foot out shoulder width apart. Almost every time I see their right hip jut out to the right as their left foot is stepping out to the left. Almost every time. And I think they're destroying their balance from the very beginning. Because if you have a partner come up and press into your left hip toward the right, as you step out, if your right hip is jutting out a little bit, they push you right off balance.
Yep.
But if you ground it and have Pung and connect that ground to your left hip and step that right foot out, it's a lot stronger. The structure is better. Those are little things. You know, you go through the form and the closing of the legs, you know, there are a lot of times it's a lot easier to knock someone over your leg if you're closing your leg rather than moving it in the same direction. I love that stuff. It's fascinating.
Absolutely.
Me too.
Absolutely. Owen, got any questions?
Yeah, for sure. I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you about your podcast. So, when did you start it, and kind of what was the inspiration?
Well, I started it in December 2014, and I thought I wanted to talk
to
people who are internal artists who speak English. One of the things that, you know, one of my teachers, Mark Watson, would go off on Tai Chi magazine and how everyone on the cover and most everybody was Asian. And over time, I thought, well, maybe some of the English-speaking guys, I know there are some good teachers, men and women. Let's spotlight them a little bit.
Sure.
But ask them questions and let them explain in English, you know, about these arts and their journey. That inspires me. So I've talked with people from the very beginning. Michael Critton was my first one, Chen Hui Shen's husband. And the expense and the trouble and the work people go through to learn these arts and to seek out the teachers is fascinating to me. And so I learn from every interview I do, and I'm inspired by it. And that was my goal. But I also like to, everybody who listens, I want them to walk away with something that will help them in their journey as well. So that's why I did it. You know, I mean, let's face it, I wanted to promote the teachers. Give them publicity. And in exchange, I became more known as a purveyor of information. And so it's a win-win for everybody. I promote my website, my blog. I promote theirs. There are enough students for everybody, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
I'm not a competitor to anybody. I don't. And, you know, the online school, I started that in 2008. And a lot of people said, you can't teach that way. And suddenly, when COVID hit, everybody's online.
That's right.
That's it. But So it's interesting. I think my wife thought I was nuts when I said, I'm going to do an online kung fu school. And it is hard to learn, but that's why Zoom makes it so much better, because I have almost 1,000 videos on my website.
That's amazing.
That I have created, taking from step by step. But nobody learns through a video and can reproduce it without coaching. Mm-hmm. You have to have the live one-on-one coaching where you say, okay, you think you're moving this way. Let me show you how to do it
and guide
through it. And when you do that, online teaching is great. The only thing missing is the actual touching hands and hands-on. But so I've learned with Nabil for 3 years, except for 2 workshops, and it's changed my Tai Chi. So I know it works.
That's awesome. Thanks. I was going to ask, well, first I wanted to say thank you for your podcast, because I've listened to, I don't know how many, if not all of them, and many of them multiple times, because I get a lot of mileage out of that stuff. So thank you. But I was going to ask if you had a particular interview or a particular guest that was, not necessarily a favorite, but one that it really impacted you in some way that you can think of, just, you know, offhand, when you go, yeah, that one or this one or these two or.
Oh, I think actually the one that I like all of them. By the time I put them on, I've learned something. But Douglas Gentile, the Zen Buddhist who teaches at Iowa State University, I interviewed him a little over a year ago. And that was such an enjoyable interview, to talk about Buddhism and Zen and connecting. And I really enjoy that part of the internal arts.
I think I've listened to that interview about 3 times, Ken.
Have you really?
I don't know. You know what's funny about it? Every time I listen to it, there's something else that's in there. And I don't know if you find this. I'll listen to our old podcast, the interviews, because we just started interviewing folks back in December. And so we're kind of new to the interview part.
I'm glad you did that. I'm really glad
you started doing that. Thank you. We had to figure out our audio. We had to figure out how we're going to do it, time schedule, all these other things, because we're not full-time teachers. We're 9-to-5 guys. And I have a weird schedule driving the bus. You know, I change every 4 months, my schedule changes. So we try to fit all of that in. But there are so many other people out there that I think we want to interview and talk to, but I'll go listen to the old interviews 2 or 3 times. And it's not to hear Owen and I, but every time I listen to that person, I get something different.
Yeah.
Just like reading a good book, you know, those layers.
I thought about doing some best of podcasts where I go back and I lift my favorite segments.
No, that'd be awesome.
I also thought about putting my favorite parts in a book, lessons from the podcast, you know, and,
that'd be great.
Give everybody credit, put their websites up and everything. And I think that would make a really good book to refer to things, because you can't go back and listen
to all of them.
I think there's so much gold in there. When I listen to them again, I think, oh, that was great. You know, it's all inspiring. So I may work on some of that.
There are these little programs out there that will organize something by a term or a word. Like if the term balance is used, it would go through all your podcasts and pull out what people said about balance.
Wow.
Or pull out what people would say, you know, those highlights about push hands, or pull out what people would say about stances and things like that. And it might be kind of cool to do your book, not just a best of, but here's what this guy thinks balance is. Mm-hmm. Here's how this guy trains push hands. Here's how this gal trains structure, you know, those kind of things. So it's kind of multiple opinions on those similar topics, because that's what I do when I listen to podcasts. I'm a weirdo. I actually listen to a lot of boxers. I listen to a lot of wrestling coaches, and I've got a good friend, Josh McKinney, that's got a great podcast. He's out of Missouri somewhere. He has the I Suck at Jiu-Jitsu podcast. and it's a great name for a podcast, great name for a podcast. But what I like about Josh, for a relatively young man, he's about to turn 30 this year and have his first child with his wife. He speaks about training like a coach. He talks about rhythm. He talks about timing. He talks about pace. He talks about position. And those are things that I can relate to, even though I do Chinese martial arts. It's a vocabulary and a terminology that, like you're talking about interviewing people here in the West that speak English. I think sometimes we get too involved with some of the Chinese terminology and we're not looking at things like balance, structure, timing, pace, all those other things that we can actually use in our Tai Chi, in our Xing Yi, in our Bagua, in our Wing Chun, in our Choi Li Foot, or whatever it is we might be training.
One of the things that makes it harder for me to find guests, too, is it's a woo-woo-free zone.
Mm. Yes, we are, too. We try to be.
I'd research everybody who's suggested as a guest, and I run across a lot of the mystical stuff. I just kind of back away a little bit, you know, if they're, but that's just me, you know, other people may be into that. And, the guest on my show that said that all the gray haired people in this Tai Chi class see their hair turn black.
I remember that one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just couldn't believe it at the time. I didn't argue because I don't argue with my guests. But I lost a lot of respect. I don't know why people would say something like that. Because I must be doing Tai Chi wrong. My hair gets whiter every year.
Oh, goodness. That's a good one. That's a good one. I love it. I love it. Owen, I know you've got a great question for Ken. So do you want to ask him that great question?
Maybe I have to go now.
It's the married man. It's a married man question.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm married. I don't have any children, but you know, I find that my hobby, if you want to call it that, being martial arts, it takes up a lot of time. And a lot of that time is kind of spent by myself, you know, training and practicing and if I'm not, you know, in class or I'm not teaching. And I was wondering if, you know, you had any advice for, you know, any of the other married people out there and who's listening to the podcast about sort of balancing married life with martial life or at work or anything like that.
Oh, I don't know that I'm the best person. I'm on my third marriage.
Well, Nancy seems pretty fantastic because you mentioned her quite a bit. And I've got to say, I'm just as much of a fan as Nancy as you, sir.
Well, on our second date, I took her by my school. At the time, I was in a space, and I whipped out my broadsword. And so that won her over because she said, Kung Fu was my favorite show.
You got lucky. Nice.
But, yeah, she's always been a supporter, but, you know – I think it's just you're right, Owen. I think you just have to find the right balance, and she does her thing, and yeah, you know, she retired in December, so she's here every day now. Before she would go to work, and I'd have the whole day to do what I needed.
Right, sure.
Now, but you know, at 70, I'm also thinking maybe I need to step back a little bit. It's just hard because I love it so much.
Yeah.
So during the day, she's doing her thing. I'm in here working, writing, practicing outside or in the basement. In my second marriage, my wife was not as supportive. She just kind of, but that had other problems. So I don't know. I think you have to do what's – we love the arts, but the arts aren't going to hold our hand when we're on our deathbed.
That's right.
When I get to the end of my life, I'm not going to think, damn, I wish I did another lousy Yulu.
Right.
I wish I did 8 main palms for him one more time. I'm going to think, I need one more day with Nancy. Mm-hmm. So you just have to, too much yang leads to yin, too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's well said.
It's the yin yang.
Could I ask you this though, Ken? You have one lung. You've been through a lot in your life and you are 70. And I've watched your videos, even the recent ones, and you move fantastic for anybody at any age.
Well, thank you.
Do you think part of that is that dedication to the martial arts? Because, you know, I think too many people look for that mysticism that you're talking about. But like for me, I have a ridiculous job. Right now I'm working 55 hours, 5 days a week. I sit 10 and a half hours to 11 hours every day. So the thing that I'm fighting is sitting.
Yeah.
It's sitting under high stress and high tension for long periods of time. So Bagua has helped open up my hips. It's helped open up my back. It's helped strengthen my knees. Xing Yi has helped my shoulders and my neck. The relaxation in the Wing Chun has helped my nervous system for when somebody cuts me off in traffic, because I don't get cut off one time or two times a day, Ken. I get cut off 15 to 20 times a day. That's a lot to deal with. Oh, so yeah. Maybe that dedication to that training will get you those more quality days with Nancy. That's that. Just 2 cents for what it is.
I think several things go into it. You know, I didn't have the greatest genes to begin with. My dad died at 61. His dad at 69. Mm. But I believed in cross training from the very beginning.
Very much so.
And I had a lot of people in Tai Chi, especially 20 years ago, 30 years ago, saying you don't need weight training if you're doing Tai Chi. That's all you need. Man, that's a mistake. Your muscles need to be strong. And that's why I got through losing the lung and having them pierce my heart with the wire accidentally. I was on a ventilator for almost 2 weeks. Mm. They didn't think I was going to make it. I was laying there thinking about a tournament coming up in 6 months.
I love it.
Ended up competing in that tournament and got a trophy, first place. Breathing like a freight train by the end of it, but with one lung. But just have fun and make your body as strong as you can be within reason. You don't need to bench press 350.
Sure.
Bench press 110 times, you're doing really well.
Absolutely. And
do chin-ups and do push-ups and crunches and make your body strong, because the only reason I got through what I did, the doctor said, was the condition I was in. Mm-hmm. And Tai Chi alone won't do it, because that doesn't really work the upper body that well. So, yeah, and just be determined. Work on your goal. What do you love? Just keep setting goals. Set steps to achieve that goal and do it. Just step by step. And just like learning Tai Chi or Xing Yi or Bagua, you start with one move, you learn the next move, you practice mm-hmm. those two, add one more to it. Before you know it, it seems like you're climbing a mountain, but suddenly you know the whole form. Mm-hmm. Then you work for the next 20 years to refine it. I don't mean to get off on a soapbox.
No, please do. We love that. Share your opinion, share your truth. What are some things now after? Here's another question. So obviously training with Nabil has changed how you look at your Chen Tai Chi. Has it also changed the lens that you use for analyzing your Xing Yi and your Bagua?
Yes. Yeah. I think, for example, the use of the quad, closing of the leg. When I do a move like sweep the rider from the horse, you know, I'm keeping my leg closed as I sweep the rider. That's Chung style, but I'm sure you have similar moves. And one of the things I've been thinking about a lot planning to do a live class about is the closing of the legs. How is that working in by the flower under the leaf and doing the switching and the circle walking? In every movement, how do these mechanics work? How do they make you stronger and give you that relaxed power that you want and the ability to change quickly? So, yeah, it all filters in together. You know, you learn something good in Bagua. It should make you affect your Tai Chi as well. And the spiraling is good for both arts. Mm-hmm. I see a lot more Shin Tai Chi and Bagua similarities. Xingyi is kind of its own animal. And,
yeah, you know,
it's not going to try to uproot you and control your center. It's going to knock your head off.
Yeah.
But I love Xingyi.
I do too.
The other two are so, some of the mechanics are really nicely intertwined. Mm-hmm.
Ken, is there any good books on martial arts that you would
actually
suggest?
Actually, I bought one today that I saw on your website. I think Owen's website. Mm. On the straight and the curved.
Yes.
I saw that this morning. I was finding out more information about you guys looking online. And so I got on Amazon and bought that. Should be here Sunday.
Yeah, cool.
Books. Oh, I've got so many. I've got my library behind me.
It's a good library.
Like it is.
Well, there's more down here, but those are the main kung fu books. Yeah, I think I always go back to Tao Jeet Kune Do as one of my Bibles. But sure. There are a lot of them out there. That's my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Love it. Well, Ken, I don't want to take up too much of your time. Is there anything you wanted to ask us? Because I told you, you know, if you felt like asking us some weird questions, go for it. We'd love to chat with you just a few more minutes while we got you.
How does your philosophy play into your art?
Personal philosophy. Like maybe like I like to study Taoism, Buddhism, those kind of things.
Yeah.
Owen, do you want me to tackle?
How do you make it part of your life?
Do you want me to tackle that one first?
Yeah.
I grew up in the middle of the Rocky Mountain National Park. I grew up close to the western entrance to the Rocky Mountain National Park, a place called Grand Lake, Granby, and Winter Park. And my first job, Ken, I'm middle aged, so I get to use this terminology. Working for my dad. I'll be 44 in September. So
that's almost middle aged.
My first job was working for my dad as a selective cut logger, and we were meat hunters. And so I've always had, and I'm about a quarter Native American, so I've always had an affinity for nature and the outdoors. And being a part of it, and not only just using it, but actually being a steward of the land. And I was 16 years old taking a world literature class in Granby at my high school. And we went over some of the Tao Te Ching and some of the Chuang Tzu. And it was the first time, because I was raised Southern Baptist, and about 11 years old when I found out that my best friend was going to go to hell because he didn't call God the same name that I did. I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I can agree with that. So I kind of went on looking for my own things. I always felt at home and at peace in nature. And so when I started reading some of these nature poets that the Chinese had from ancient China, and the same with the Japanese, I felt at home with their writing. And so I try to find time when I have days off. You know, we've got beautiful parks down here. Or I'll go visit my mother. She lives in the middle of the Rocky Mountains. I'll go visit my mother and we'll go take a walk. We'll go take a drive in the country. And so I really try to find an emotional release process, if you will, through being in nature. And that's probably, if I had to wear a hat, I'm probably more on the Taoist side of things. I don't practice any of the magic practices. You know, I focus on the breathing work that Owen teaches me and the breathing work that I've learned from others, some Neigong and some Qigong, those kind of things. But being a part of nature, and Owen's, I'm not going to speak for him, but that's one of the things that he does too. I know anytime he can get out in nature and with the wife or himself, I know he's taken long hikes, and we live in a beautiful part of the United States. So that's a long way maybe of answering that question. Also, you might laugh at this, Ken. Do you remember the old DuPont Teflon commercials in the 80s for the first nonstick frying pan? They'd crack an egg in there and it would slide right off.
Yeah.
Well, with my job that I've done for 14 years this October, you have to have a DuPont Teflon layer for bullshit. And so, so as people cut me off, as somebody comes to my bus and calls me everything, but a brown man, whatever it is, I try not to hold on to that moment. I try not to hold on to that anger. I might feel angry and I might be angry, but I try not to let that moment dictate my abilities of driving. Because that's what happens with a lot of our drivers. Someone will say the wrong thing to them and they will carry around that stress and that tension in their body all day. And it does affect their driving. And they're not only worried about their own lives, but the passengers in the bus too. Yeah. So that's maybe a Buddhist path of, just trying to let that go and not find attachment. Cause I think we think attachment in the West. Well, we think, okay, I've got a fancy car. I've got some great books. I've got cool workout implements. I've got thousands of dollars worth of that. Most people find attachment being to something that they love. Well, you can also attach yourself to something that you hate. And I think we need to learn to let go of the thing, find a process to let that go and not be attached.
Sometimes being mindful is good. I mean, it was a revelation to me when I realized, okay, I'm not supposed to blank my mind as I do Tai Chi. I should be mindful on the mechanics and how they would work in application. And throughout the form, that's what I'm thinking about and feeling. And by the end of the form, it's like meditation, because you haven't had the monkey mind thinking about everything you need to do today and bills, and you're focused.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, I think in daily life, if you try, it's all hard. Something's bothering you like that, you focus on what you're doing now. Focus on what the person's saying in front of you instead of what else you need to do. And we just try to get better every day. Still trying.
One of the things that Owen taught me a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, when I started training the Xing Yi with him, he's like, you're not tuning out. Do not go into La La Land. He's like, when you're doing these forms or you're standing, he's like, I'm going to give you things to be aware of. So instead of tuning out or going into a trance, you actually need to tune into yourself. You need to look for those points in your body. You need to, look for where you're balanced and unbalanced. And so I think that's another great process too, is learning how to tune into yourself and find those different things.
I'd love to meet you guys in person and work out with you. And he speaks so highly of you all, and I really admire that, and would love to get together with you guys sometime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd love that.
And you can critique my Xing Yi. I need it.
I don't know if I'm qualified.
Oh, I think you are.
Owen, did you have anything as far as like philosophies or maybe some of the Taoist practice or Buddhist practice that, expressed?
I think that, I'm glad everybody else went first. I think because it's a little easy for me, right? But I think it's summary, my primary art is Bagua. I've always loved it. I've always been fascinated by it. But Bagua is the art of change. And I think it's that idea of being malleable and changeable. And just that has given me a lot of flexibility in my life. you know, professionally and personally and, you know, as a martial artist and, you know, very much like you being able to, you know, realize that there are other things out there that are certainly worth studying and that will have enriched my life greatly, you know, as instead of getting locked into a particular style or concept or something like that, having that open mind you were talking about earlier. I think that if anything, I would say that. And I always tell everybody when these types of conversations come up for me, I love what the Dalai Lama said about his religion. And he said, my religion is kindness. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, to me, that really helps embody my personal philosophy and life interpersonally and as well as, you know, my martial arts. So
it's interesting. My favorite shirts say do good, be kind.
Yeah.
I wear them all mm-hmm. the time. I get pictures with them, but someone gave me that shirt and it rang in my mind. Every day I got up thinking, do good, be kind. Isn't that all we need to do? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't need to judge anybody else on how they live. Just do good, be kind. And every day that I go out, I think, how can I do good, be kind right now? And it's that in itself can just do wonders for your outlook and the way you see people. You see people in a store. I see an old lady in the aisle of a store, and you know people are looking right through her. Not, she's old. Nobody cares. Mm-hmm. I meet her eye and I smile. And I always get a smile back. Like, you noticed. Mm-hmm. That's just it's a good way to live. That's kindness. I'm glad you brought that up.
That's good. Maybe one last question, Ken. Is there anybody besides, of course, we're honored by us, anybody out there that you would like to train with in person? Maybe pick on old Byron Jacobs or, you know,
a mutual friend of ours. Yeah. Byron is the greatest. I'd love to meet him sometime. Almost everybody I've interviewed has skill and experience that I would love to see, you know, work with them, taste their cup of tea and see, you know, I wish I had people around here to push hands with, but there are guys in the area who are masters with William C.C. Chen that won't push hands with me. I just want to see what they have and experience. I've heard so much about it. I can't, but it's hard for people to really step out and I don't know.
You know, it's wild about your statement right there. That actually brings us right back to the beginning in the Shaolin Do when you couldn't do any other tournaments.
Right.
Except for the Shaolin Do tournaments. And that's something that's in your, when you tell your story to other people, that's like not only sticks in my head, but sticks in my craw. And it's the same. It sounds like with these other Tai Chi folks, it's like, oh, we'll push hands with the people in our lineage, but nobody else. Well, how do you know you got it? How do you know you got it? You know, it doesn't have to be a fight for the death because I don't think you'd do that, Ken, but, but how do you know you've got it unless you work with other people?
And how do you know what you need to work on? I want people to throw me around. I want people to get the better of me so that hey, do that again. Let me work on
what I need to
do here. But, man, if all you want to do is show that your style is the best. I mean, we did have one group that got together briefly, and there were people who had attitudes that, you know, they get you and they go, ha ha, you know, and I thought, come on, because they would get me and I'd go, oh yeah, okay. Now, how do I work on that? I'm defending it. But it's so important to be able to be with people with the expectation and the desire to lose, invest in loss. You invest in it, you lose, but you learn, and so you get better. And that's an investment in yourself. I wish more people could do that. And unfortunately, I live in a small area. that if I lived in a bigger city, it probably wouldn't be as much trouble.
You know, that's something we actually have an episode we're going to be dropping. So later down the road, I'll give you a little taste of it. But we talk about that, and that is something that is designed at least into a good Brazilian jiu-jitsu gym, is you're investing in loss. Every time you lose, what did you do wrong? And yep. Two, you're trying to learn from your partner. If you're a black belt, you're learning from your white belt partner. If you're a white belt, you're learning from your black belt partner. And I think that that's something in Chinese martial arts that we need more of, is to try to learn and help each other learn, not just, ha-ha, I got you, sucker.
I remember being in the Omaha school, the Yili Chan, and there was a black belt named Bob Roach, and he could show applications on these movements, and I thought, how in the world did he know that? I mean, it seemed so...
And then, mystical?
Yeah, not mystical, but just so skillful.
Mm.
His knowledge was so deep. Oh, this movement means this or this or this.
Whoa.
And then as you put in time and you study it, then, okay, yeah, I can do that. And people come in and you show them an application. They go, whoa. And it's like, yeah, that's great. Circle turns. This has been fun.
Yeah. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you so
again,
much.
Your podcast has been a flag bearer for a lot of other great martial arts podcasts, not just Kung Fu, but just great podcasting, great interviewing. Thank you again. We look forward to your, and you've got, do you have an interview later today? I think you've got an interview later today yourself, don't you?
Yeah, I'm interviewing Tony Wong. He's studied with a lot of Chen Tai Chi masters, and he's studied with the Qigong master. Looking forward to hearing that.
I think he's done some Wing Chun too. You'll see, have to see if
yes.
he still practices yes. any and finds
Kenneth
any.
Kenneth Chung, I believe, was his teacher.
Kenneth Chung, which is a Liang Shun lineage. That was Ip Man's first student.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. So I want to have you guys on the podcast as well and grill you about your arts and your methodology sort of thing.
So if anybody wants to reach out to you, where can they find you? Like websites or emails or?
The website is internalfightingarts.com.
Mm-hmm.
The blog is internalfightingartsblog.com. And if they anywhere they get podcasts, Internal Fighting Arts Podcast.
Awesome.
By that.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you. Good to see you
yep.
guys.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ken. Have a blessed day, my friend.
Have a good one. Thank you.